File 32.
But in Germany, through the medium of the schools, the press, and the comic papers, an idea of the Englishman was gradually formed, which was bound eventually to lead to the worst kind of self-deception. This absurdity slowly but persistently spread into every quarter of German life. The result was an undervaluation for which we have had to pay a heavy penalty. The delusion was so profound that the Englishman was looked upon as a shrewd businessman, but personally a coward, even to an incredible degree. Unfortunately, our lofty teachers of professional history did not bring home to the minds of their pupils the truth that it is not possible to build up such a mighty organization as the British Empire by mere swindle and fraud. The few who called attention to that truth were either ignored or silenced. I can vividly recall to mind the astonished looks of my comrades when they found themselves personally face to face for the first time with the Tommies in Flanders. After a few days of fighting, the consciousness slowly dawned upon our soldiers that those Scotsmen were not like the ones we had seen described and caricatured in the comic papers and mentioned in the communiques. It was then that I formed my first ideas of the efficiency of various forms of propaganda. Such a falsification, however, served the purpose of those who had fabricated it. Caricature of the Englishman, though false, could be used to prove the possibility of conquering the world peacefully by commercial means. Where the Englishman succeeded, we should also succeed. Our far greater honesty and our freedom from that specifically English perfidy would be assets on our side. Thereby it was hoped that the sympathy of the smaller nations and the confidence of the greater nations could be gained more easily. We did not realize that our honesty was an object of profound aversion for other people because we ourselves believed in it. The rest of the world looked on our behavior as the manifestation of a shrewd deceitfulness. But when the revolution came, then they were amazed at the deeper insight it gave them into our mentality, sincere even beyond the limits of stupidity. Once we understand the part played by that absurd notion of conquering the world by peaceful commercial means, we can clearly understand how that other absurdity, the Triple Alliance, came to exist. With what state, then, could an alliance have been made? In alliance with Austria, we could not acquire new territory by military means, even in Europe. And this very fact was the real reason for the inner weakness of the Triple Alliance. Bismarck could not permit himself such a makeshift for the necessities of the moment, but certainly not any of his bungling successors. And least of all, when the foundations no longer existed on which Bismarck had formed the Triple Alliance. In Bismarck's time, Austria could still be looked upon as a German state, but the gradual introduction of universal suffrage turned the country into a parliamentary Babel, in which the German voice was scarcely audible. From the viewpoint of racial policy, this alliance with Austria was simply disastrous. A new Slavic great power was allowed to grow up close to the frontiers of the German Empire. Later on, this power was bound to adopt towards Germany an attitude different from that of Russia, for example. The alliance was thus bound to become more empty and more feeble, because the only supporters of it were losing their influence and were being systematically pushed out of the more important public offices. about the year 1900, the alliance with Austria had already entered the same phase as the alliance between Austria and Italy. Here also only one alternative was possible, either to take the side of the Habsburg monarchy, or to raise a protest against the oppression of the German element in Austria. But generally speaking, when one takes such a course, it is bound eventually to lead to open conflict. From the psychological point of view also, the triple decreases according as such alliance limits its object to the defence of the status quo. But on the other hand, an alliance will increase its cohesive strength the more the parties concerned in it may hope to use it as a means of reaching some practical goal of expansion. Here, as everywhere else, strength does not lie in defence, but in attack. This truth was recognised in various quarters, but unfortunately not by the so-called elected representatives of the people. As early as 1912, Ludendorff, who was then colonel and a commander of the general staff, pointed out these weak features of the alliance in a memorandum which he then drew up. But of course the statesman did not attach any importance or value to that document. In general, it would seem as if reason were a faculty that is active only in the case of ordinary mortals, but that it is entirely absent when we come to deal with that branch of the species known as diplomats. It was lucky for Germany that the War of 1914 broke out with Austria as its direct cause, for thus the Habsburgs were compelled to participate. Had the origin of the war been otherwise, Germany would have been left to her own resources. The Habsburg state would never have been ready or willing to take part in a war for the origin of which Germany was responsible. What was the object of so much obloquy later in the case of Italy's decision would have taken place only earlier in the case of Austria. In other words, if Germany had been forced to go to war for some reason of its own, Austria would have remained neutral in order to safeguard the state against a revolution which might begin immediately after the war had started. The Slav element would have preferred to smash up the dual monarchy in 1914 rather than permit it to come to the assistance of Germany. But at that time, there were only a few who understood all the dangers and aggravations which resulted from the alliance with the Danubian monarchy. In the first place, Austria had too many enemies who were eagerly looking forward to obtain the heritage of that decrepit state, so that these people gradually developed a certain animosity against Germany, because Germany was an obstacle to their desires, inasmuch as it kept the dual monarchy from falling to pieces, a consummation that was hoped for and yearned for on all sides. The conviction developed that Vienna could be reached only by passing through Berlin. In the second place, by adopting this policy, Germany lost its best and most promising chances of other alliances. In place of these possibilities, one now observed a growing tension in the relations with Russia, and even with Italy. And this in spite of the fact that the general attitude in Rome was just as favourable to Germany as it was hostile to Austria, a hostility which lay dormant in the individual Italian and broke out violently on occasion. Since a commercial and industrial policy had been adopted, no motive was left for waging war against Russia. Only the enemies of the two countries, Germany and Russia, could have an active interest in such a war under these circumstances. As a matter of fact, it was only the Jews and the Marxists who tried to stir up bad blood between the two states. In the third place, the alliance constituted a permanent danger to German security, for any great power that was hostile to Bismarck's empire could mobilize a whole lot of other states in a war against Germany by promising them tempting spoils at the expense of the Austrian ally. It was possible to arouse the whole of Eastern Europe against Austria, especially Russia, and Italy also. The world coalition which had developed under the leadership of King Edward could never have become a reality if Germany's ally, Austria, had not offered such an alluring prospect of booty. It was this fact alone which made it possible to combine so many heterogeneous states with divergent interests into one common phalanx of attack. Every member could hope to enrich himself at the expense of Austria if he joined in the general attack against Germany. The fact that Turkey was also a tacit party to the unfortunate alliance with Austria augmented Germany's peril to an extraordinary degree. Jewish international finance needed this bait of the Austrian heritage in order to carry out its plans of ruining Germany, for Germany had not yet surrendered to the general control which the international captains of finance and trade exercised over the other states. Thus it was possible to consolidate that coalition and make it strong enough and brave enough, through the sheer weight of numbers, to join in bodily conflict with the horned Siegfried. The alliance with the Habsburg monarchy, which I loathed while still in Austria, was the subject of grave concern on my part, and caused me to meditate on it so persistently that finally I came to the conclusions which I have mentioned above. In the small circles which I frequented at that time, I did not conceal my conviction that this sinister agreement with a state doomed to collapse would also bring catastrophe to Germany if she did not free herself from it in time. I have never for a moment wavered in that firm conviction, even when the tempest of the world war seemed to have made shipwreck of the reasoning faculty itself, and had put blind enthusiasm in its place, even among those circles where the coolest and hardest objective thinking ought to have held sway. In the trenches, I voiced and upheld my own opinion whenever these problems came under discussion. I held that to abandon the Habsburg monarchy would involve no sacrifice if Germany could thereby reduce the number of her own enemies, for the millions of Germans who had donned the steel helmet had done so not to fight for the maintenance of a corrupt dynasty, but rather for the salvation of the German people. Before the war, there were occasions on which it seemed that at least one section of the German public had some slight misgivings about the political wisdom of the alliance with Austria. From time to time, German conservative circles issued warnings against being overconfident about the worth of that alliance. But, like every other reasonable suggestion made at that time, it was thrown to the winds. The general conviction was that the right measures had been adopted to conquer the world, that the success of these measures would be enormous and the sacrifices negligible. Once again, the uninitiated layman could do nothing but observe how the elect were marching straight ahead towards disaster, and enticing their beloved people to follow them as the rats followed the Pied Piper of Hamelin. If we would look for the deeper grounds which made it possible to foist on the people this absurd notion of peacefully conquering the world through commercial penetration, and how it was possible to put forward the maintenance of world peace as a national aim, we shall find that these grounds lay in a general morbid condition that had pervaded the whole body of German political thought. The triumphant progress of technical science in Germany, and the marvellous development of German industries and commerce, led us to forget that a powerful state had been the necessary prerequisite of that success. On the contrary, certain circles went even so far as to give vent to the theory that the state owed its very existence to these phenomena, that it was, above all, an economic institution, and should be constituted in accordance with economic interests. Therefore, it was held, the state was dependent on the economic structure. This condition of things was looked upon and glorified as the soundest and most normal arrangement. Now, the truth is that the state in itself has nothing whatsoever to do with any definite economic concept or definite economic development. It does not arise from a compact made between contracting parties with a certain delimited territory for the purpose of serving economic ends. The state is a community of living beings who have kindred physical and spiritual natures, organized for the purpose of assuring the conservation of their own kind and to help towards fulfilling those ends which Providence has assigned to that particular race or racial branch. Therein, and therein alone, lie the purpose and meaning of a state. Economic activity is one of the many auxiliary reasons which are necessary for the attainment of those aims. But economic activity is never the origin or purpose of a state, except where a state has been originally founded on a false and unnatural basis. And this alone explains why a state as such does not necessarily need a certain delimited territory as a condition of its establishment. This condition becomes a necessary prerequisite only among those people who would provide and assure subsistence for their kinsfolk through their own industry, which means that they are ready to carry on the struggle for existence by means of their own work. People who can sneak their way like parasites into the human body politic and make others work for them under various pretenses can form a state without possessing any definite delimited territory. This is chiefly applicable to that parasitic nation which, particularly at the present time, preys upon the honest portion of mankind. I mean the Jews. The Jewish state has never been delimited in space. It has been spread all over the world, without any frontiers whatsoever, and has always been constituted from the membership of one race exclusively. That is why the Jews have always formed a state within the state. One of the most ingenious tricks ever devised has been that of sailing the Jewish ship of state under the flag of religion, and thus securing that tolerance which Aryans are always ready to grant to different religious faiths. But the Mosaic law is really nothing else than the doctrine of the preservation of the Jewish race. Therefore, this law takes in all spheres of sociological, political, and economic science which have a bearing on the main end in view. The instinct for the preservation of one's own species is the primary cause that leads to the formation of human communities. Hence, the state is a racial organism, and not an economic organization. The difference between the two is so great as to be incomprehensible to our contemporary so-called statesmen. That is why they like to believe that the state may be constituted as an economic structure, whereas the truth is that it has always resulted from the exercise of those qualities which are part of the will to preserve the species and the race. But these qualities always exist and operate through the heroic virtues and have nothing to do with commercial egoism. for the conservation of the species always presupposes that the individual is ready to sacrifice himself. Such is the meaning of the poet's lines. Und setzet ihr nicht das Leben ein, nie wird euch das Leben gewonnen sein. And if you do not stake your life, you will never win life for yourself.